We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Listener, summer nights are heating up, and if your mattress is trapping heat, it might be time for a change. Avocado Green Mattresses use breathable, organic materials that sleep cooler naturally. All Avocado mattresses are crafted with certified organic latex, wool, and cotton. Breathable materials that sleep cooler and are free from harmful chemicals. Destined to provide exceptional comfort and support with options ranging from gentle firm to plush, meeting diverse sleep needs and preferences. Take our mattress quiz to see which mattress and comfort option is right for you. And it promotes better sleep through breathable, naturally temperature regulating materials, which can improve overall well-being. No harmful chemicals, just healthy materials for a cleaner, safer sleep. Avocado is committed to sustainability. Every avocado mattress is made from eco-friendly materials and built to last. High quality means fewer replacements, better for the planet and your wallet. And avocado mattresses are ethical and transparent. From sourcing to production, Avocado holds itself to the highest sustainability and safety standards. Certified organic and always honest. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today and check out their mattress and bedding sale. Avocado. Dream of better.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Center, which has since been renamed the Alaskan Vocational Technical Center. Seward is a 2-hour drive south of Anchorage, east of the Kenai Fjords National Park on the Kenai Peninsula. Megan was born and raised in Delta Junction, Alaska. She spent her time riding horses and motorcycles, listening to rock music, and fishing and hunting on the Yukon River. Megan was last seen leaving her dormitory laundry room on July 7, 1973. After 3 days of trying to track her down, Megan's roommate reported her missing. Megan had no known record of trouble. All of her personal belongings, including her ID, were left behind. At the time of Megan's disappearance, Robert was on parole for his attack on Susan Heppard. His parole records show that he was in Seward on the weekend that Megan disappeared. Other records also show that at this time, Robert owned a large boat, which he moored at the Seward docks. Only an 11-minute walk from the Seward Skill Center, where Megan was last seen, Robert used his 36-foot cabin cruiser to fish in the Seward area. And he learned to scuba dive by taking some divers he'd met on the docks out on his boat. Megan Emmerich was never seen again, and her body has never been found. But police believe she may be buried at Resurrection Bay, near Seward. 2 years after Megan's disappearance, 22-year-old Mary Thill went missing on July 5, 1975. Like Megan, Mary was also a student at the Seward Skill Center, but lived on Lower Point Road. Mary's parents both died when she was still in high school, leaving the children in the family orphaned. Despite this hardship, Mary was known always to be smiling and friendly. She had a large circle of friends, was a capable student, and was crowned high school prom queen. By the summer of 1975, Mary was married, and her husband was working in the North Slope region of the state, on the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline. On the day Mary disappeared, a friend gave her a ride to the Seward Bakery, now known as the Ranting Raven Bakery, in downtown Seward, which was also a three-minute drive away from the nearest boat launch for those who wanted to head out and enjoy the water. Another friend reported seeing Mary between 1:30 and 2 p.m. that day at the Lowell Creek Waterfall, a 10-minute walk south of the bakery. It was completely unlike Mary to disappear without informing anyone where she was going. Her devastated husband returned from the North Slope to assist in the search for his wife, but nothing further was uncovered. At the time of Mary's disappearance, 36-year-old Robert Hansen was still on parole for his attack on Susan Heppard in late 1971. On the weekend that Mary disappeared, Robert's parole record showed that he traveled south to Seward and had access to a vehicle during his stay. Prior to departing Anchorage, Robert had asked a friend if he knew any women he could party with in Seward. Like Megan Emmerich, Mary was never seen again after that 4th of July weekend. And while her body has never been found, she too is believed to have been buried at Resurrection Bay. On October 5, 1975, the Anchorage Rape and Assault Center reported to police that a 28-year-old woman had reportedly been abducted and raped by a man a week earlier on September 28th. The woman had met her assailant at the Kit Kat Club one evening, where she worked as an exotic dancer, and had given him her telephone number. The woman said that the man called her home on September 28th and arranged to meet her at the Fork and Spoon restaurant. When the woman arrived to meet the man, he pulled a gun on her, which she described as a large semi-automatic pistol. The man forced the woman into his vehicle, which she described as a dark red 1974-75 foreign station wagon with a black interior. The woman said the man then drove her to Chugiak State Park, where he raped her and told her that if she did not do as she was told, he would kill her. The man told the woman that he and a friend both worked on the pipeline, and they were also both raping women in the Anchorage area. The man also told the woman that if she reported him to the police, she wouldn't be a credible witness because she was an exotic dancer and sex worker. The woman described the man as Caucasian, approximately 30 years old, 5'8" tall with an average build, short brownish blonde hair, blue eyes, wearing wire-rimmed glasses, and having a slight stutter. The woman had sworn staff to secrecy at the Rape and Assault Center concerning her name and said that she would not talk to police herself out of fear for her life. Given his prior record, police interviewed Robert Hansen on October 14, 1975, but he denied abducting or raping anyone on September 28th, stating that on that day he went fishing in the Seward area. Robert did say that he had met a tall, dark-haired girl at the Kit Kat Club the previous summer while his family was on vacation, and that after a brief conversation with her, the pair agreed to go back to where the girl was staying. Robert said that as he was driving along, the girl told him it would cost $100. This upset Robert, who claimed it wasn't a part of the deal, so he drove her back to the Kit Kat Club. Robert told police this girl became angry with him and started swearing, but he didn't take any action in response. Robert denied owning any pistols on the basis that his previous firearm conviction prevented him from doing so. On October 16, 1975, the woman positively identified the photograph of her assailant as Robert Hansen. However, she still refused to be identified to police, talk to them directly, or file any charges. The woman, a school teacher who had come to Alaska to make a quick buck dancing, was humiliated and wanted to put the whole thing behind her. Robert was questioned based on the license plate number the woman had provided, but without charges being pressed, he was free to go. Robert's parole period regarding the attack on Susan Heppard ended in 1976. In early November of that year, a security guard at Fred Meyer's department store in Anchorage called Robert shoplifting a chainsaw. 37-year-old Robert was charged with larceny, but expressed remorse, saying, "I know what I did was wrong, and I'm very sorry for doing so." Robert, who was already taking the drug Thorazine, was open with psychiatrists about his penchant for stealing, and it was noted that he demonstrated poor impulse control during manic episodes of his illness. Kleptomania, which is defined as the uncontrollable impulse to steal without economic need, is an example of how bipolar disorder can manifest in some people with illness. In April 1977, Robert pled guilty to the chainsaw theft. By the time he was sentenced, a subsequent psychiatric assessment noted that the drug lithium was proving effective in helping to manage and stabilize his manic episodes. Robert's psychiatrists believed that the best safeguard against Robert's bipolar disorder contributing to reoffending was continued treatment and his engagement as an active member of the community. The sentencing judge considered Robert's rehabilitation potential. He felt Robert posed a danger to the community during his manic episodes and thought it appropriate for him to continue to be isolated. Robert was sentenced to 5 years in prison on the provision that he be eligible for parole at the earliest possible date, and then he received psychiatric treatment to assist his transition back into the community. Despite this being Robert's third felony conviction, he appealed his five-year sentence as excessive on the basis that it was a property offense, that he had a solid family, employment, and financial background, and a promising prognosis for managing his mental illness. Robert's psychiatrist had prescribed lithium and therapy and reported to the sentencing court that Robert had been cooperative throughout treatment. The psychiatrist also testified that the chances of Robert engaging in future criminal activity would be greatly reduced by this ongoing treatment and continued therapy. In August 1978, the Alaskan Supreme Court concurred that Robert's sentence was excessive, given the theft of the chainsaw did not involve any physical aggression, threats, or result in any physical injury. Robert was released from prison after serving only a year, but surprisingly, was not court-ordered to take his medication. Following his release, 39-year-old Robert applied for a pilot's license. However, as he was taking lithium, the application was rejected. The long, dark nights of Alaska's freezing winters meant that entertainment was limited. The men who worked on the pipeline during the day spent their nights frequenting bars and brothels to help pass the time and seek out female company, and Robert was no exception. From the time he moved to Alaska, he continued to visit downtown Anchorage in the early hours of the morning to engage the services of exotic dancers and sex workers, or as he preferred to call them, bad girls. Robert's preferred sexual activity with sex workers was to have oral sex performed on him. It was something he later said he would never ask his wife to do. After all, she was someone he considered a good girl. In Robert's mind, good girls didn't perform certain sexual acts, even on their husbands. That was something only bad girls did. Christy Hayes was a sex worker and exotic dancer at the Embers Bar in Anchorage. On October 14, 1979, she met a man at the bar and agreed to a date with him when she finished her shift. The man paid her $110 for sex, and when she finished work, they made their way back from the bar to a camper that the man had parked outside. Prior to getting inside, the man asked Christy if she wanted to take an airplane ride with him southwest to Palmer, 45-minute drive away, but she declined. When Christy climbed into the camper, she noticed a number of animal furs and rifles. Undeterred, she stripped naked, but the man kept his clothes on. Suddenly, he pointed a .357 Magnum revolver in her face and told her to cooperate, saying, "I don't want to hurt you, but I just don't like quickies." The man bound Christy's feet and hands with guitar wire, shoved her into the bunk of the camper, locked her inside, and drove off. Christy started shouting that she needed to get home to her kids and managed to free her hands and feet. When the man noticed his captive was free of her bindings, he slammed on the brakes, causing Christy to fall to the floor. The man pointed the gun at Christy from the cab of the camper before moving to the back door. Seizing her opportunity at escape, Christy slid into the cab of the camper through the connecting window, closed it, and locked the doors. But her attacker still had the keys, which meant Christy was trapped. The man approached the window of the cab, saying he didn't mean to hurt her. Christy demanded her clothes back, but the man responded by punching the driver's side window of the cab, shattering the glass. Christy escaped out the passenger door, running naked and bleeding down the street, frantically knocking on the door of nearby houses. She had left her clothes, including a blue bag with her dancing costumes, in the camper. Christy described her attacker as approximately 40 years old, 5'10" with brown hair, and wearing a plaid hunting jacket and shirt. When the APD attended the scene, they found tire tracks and broken glass where Christy stated the camper had stopped, but nothing else came of her report. By early 1980, Christie was working at the Great Alaskan Bush Company. On March 23rd, she contacted the APD, stating she'd spotted the man at the bar who'd kidnapped her 5 months earlier. When police arrived, Christie identified the man who police recognized on site. It was Robert Hansen, who agreed to be interviewed by APD that night about the assault on Christie. Robert denied having abducted Christie or threatening her with a gun. He told police that he met her a few months earlier at the Embers Bar and had given her a ride home one night when she finished her shift. Robert claimed that during the ride home, he stopped the camper and Christie performed consensual oral sex on him. He stated that she demanded $75 for the service, but given this hadn't been discussed previously, he refused to pay. Robert claimed that Christie became angry and started screaming at him, so he threw her out of the back door of the camper. No further action was taken by the APD regarding Christie's allegation. Robert was in question about the broken glass at the site where Christie said the camper had stopped and Robert had punched the window. Nor was he asked about the clothes Christie claimed she left in the camper when she escaped. On July 2, 1980, 24-year-old sex worker Roxanne Easland was reported missing. Like many other sex workers, Roxanne used aliases, was also known as Karen Lee. Not much is known about Roxanne, but she came to Anchorage from Seattle. Prior to her disappearance, she and her boyfriend had been staying at the Budget Motel on Spenard Road in Anchorage for 2 weeks. She was last seen on June 28th near 4th Avenue in downtown Anchorage, where it was said she was to meet with an unidentified man. Roxanne was never seen again. September 7, 1980 was the last time anyone saw 41-year-old Lisa Futrell, who is also known as Betty. Not much is known about Lisa, but she relocated to Anchorage from Hawaii and worked as an exotic dancer at the Great Alaskan Bush Company. 1980 was also the year that Robert Hansen reported a burglary at his home. He told his insurance company that thieves had made off with his prized collection of taxidermied mounted animal heads. The resulting insurance claim saw Robert receive $13,000, which he used to open his own bakery in January 1981. Situated on the corner of 9th Avenue and Ingress Street, the business proved to be a roaring success. Everyone in town, including officers of the APD, bought their donuts and coffee from Bob the Baker, as Robert became known. Like some of the other women who had gone missing from Anchorage, 28-year-old Malai Larson disappeared in June 1981. Nothing further is known about Malai or how she came to be reported missing to police. 24-year-old Andrea Altieri grew up in Hawaii. The daughter of then-prominent journalist and Hawaii State Senator Mason Altieri, Andrea moved to Anchorage when she took up exotic dancing and was known as a tough girl. She sometimes went by her sister's name of Lisa or the nickname Fish, and she danced under the name of Enchantment. Andrea was last seen taking a cab to the Boniface Mall in Anchorage at 11 p.m. on December 2, 1981, where she was to meet an unidentified man for a photo shoot. She was never seen again. 42-year-old Robert Hansen still had some money left over from his insurance claim regarding the theft of his hunting trophies. So in January 1982, he purchased a light plane, a blue and white Piper Super Cub. Robert was still unable to obtain a pilot's license due to taking lithium to manage his bipolar disorder, but he flew anyway. 23-year-old Sue Luna grew up in Washington State. A good friend to others, Sue loved being around people and making them laugh with her mischievous sense of humor. Sue was known for making faces and doing imitations. She was remembered to be especially good at impersonation of Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones, pursing her lips and strutting while singing Satisfaction. In May 1982, Sue traveled to Alaska for 2 weeks for a break and to visit her sister Roberta and her brother-in-law who lived in Anchorage. Roberta knew that downtown Anchorage after dark could be a risky place for a single girl, especially the crime-ridden area of 4th Avenue. She worried about Sue's safety and tried to convince her sister to carry a weapon for self-defense, but Sue didn't see a need. Even after hours, the streets of Anchorage were busy with people looking to have a good time. If anyone posed a risk, there would be plenty of people around to come to someone's aid. Sue found a combination at the Sleeping Lady Apartments, and along with her roommate, she worked the 2-to-10 shifts as an exotic dancer at the Good Times Bar in downtown Anchorage. At the bar on May 25th, Sue met an unidentified man whom she agreed to meet the next day at Alice's 210 restaurant, on the understanding that she was to be paid $300 for an hour of sex. On May 27th, Roberta went to collect Sue from her apartment so the sisters could spend the weekend together. But Sue wasn't there. Her roommate told Roberta that Sue hadn't turned up for work on May 26th. She hadn't seen Sue since she left the apartment the day before in a taxi. On May 30th, 1982, Roberta reported Sue missing to the APD. 21-year-old exotic dancer Tamara Peterson moved from Washington State to Anchorage, where she danced at the Wild Cherry. The last time anyone saw her alive was August 1982, when she took a bag with various outfits to attend a photo shoot. 24-year-old Angela Federn was known by almost everyone as Angie. She moved to Anchorage from Seattle to find work in the booming city. Angie's mother and sister both knew that she was a drug user and relied on sex work to support both her drug dependency as well as her 5-year-old daughter who lived in Fairbanks in the interior region. The family tried their best to help Angie, and in 1983, she promised her sister she'd take just one more trip to Anchorage, then return to Seattle for good. But this wasn't to be. Angie's family last heard from her in February 1983, when her phone calls home stopped. That same month, Angie was reported missing by the owner, operator of Murphy's Law, an Anchorage bar that employed exotic dancers. No official missing persons report was filed with the APD. The information was instead passed on to state troopers. Angie was said to have a date with a doctor just prior to her disappearance. Her mother, Mary, couldn't bear to think about what could have happened to her daughter, telling the media, "That was the life she chose. Angie just couldn't find it in herself to go out and get a thinking job. She did the best she could." The disappearances continued, with 22-year-old sex worker Teresa Watson, who moved to Anchorage from Sacramento, California. Not much is known about Teresa, but she was reported to have vanished between late April through March 1983. By the summer of 1983, the bodies of three women had been found buried in shallow graves in the wilderness on the outskirts of Anchorage. An unidentified woman known as Eklutna Annie, 24-year-old Joanna Messina, and 23-year-old Sherry Morrow. The women who had gone missing, generally exotic dancers, are sex workers from interstate, but not always. Both Anchorage Police Department and the Alaska State Troopers were aware of at least four other women in the area who had managed to escape a man who attacked them, as well as women who had disappeared in what law enforcement called the case of the missing dancers. There were encouraging leads from survivors, but no evidence to indicate who was responsible for the other disappearances and the murders. Our story picks back up in June of 1983 with 17-year-old Cindy Paulson, who grew up in Seattle. Cindy started running away from home at the age of 12 and was soon taken in by a pimp. By the age of 15, Cindy was using drugs, and she eventually turned to sex work to help her survive the streets. On the evening of June 13th, 1983, Cindy was working the corner of 5th Avenue and Den Alley in Anchorage when a man in a green Buick pulled up around 11:30 p.m. Cindy got in the car, and the man offered her $200 for oral sex. Once engaged in the act, Cindy's client handcuffed one of her hands to the car seat. When Cindy tried to free herself, the man pulled out a gun and held it to her head while quickly cuffing her other hand. The man repeatedly told Cindy that if she cooperated, she wouldn't get hurt. Cindy was terrified, but fought against her urge to struggle in case things got worse. But they did anyway. The man told her he was taking her to his house and proceeded to drive through the streets of Anchorage to Old Harbor Road in the suburb of Muldoon, an upper-class area not far from town. They eventually stopped at a large blue-gray ranch-style house where the man forced Cindy inside and down to the basement. There was a couch and bars on the windows. A bearskin rug was on the floor near a pool table, and the wood-paneled walls were adorned with hunting trophies in the form of mounted animal heads. The savage and pained expressions on the motionless faces made Cindy's skin crawl, but before she had time to think further, the man stripped Cindy naked, handcuffed her to a chair, and tied a rope around her neck, securing the other end to a coffee table. He casually told Cindy that she wasn't the first, and that he'd previously brought seven other girls back to his house, usually keeping them in the den for a week or more before killing them. The man raped Cindy on the rug without a condom and orgasm after only 3 minutes. He also bit her nipples and sexually assaulted her with a hammer. Afterwards, the man allowed Cindy to use the bathroom, but he followed her, keeping her restrained with a rope around her neck and handcuffs on. Cindy was hopeful at the prospect of an escape route via a bathroom window, but she found it nailed shut. When Cindy returned from the bathroom, the man sat her on the floor near the pool table, kept her handcuffed, and replaced the rope with a chain he wrapped around her neck 4 times, securing the other end to a metal post. She could move around a little, but not much. The chain was tight, and if Cindy moved too much, she'd be choked. Her captor lay down on the couch to have a nap and turned on the TV, but warned her not to wake him.
Listener, did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? I recently took the True Age test from True Diagnostic and discovered my biological age, and the results completely changed the way I think about my health. Biological age is a powerful indicator of how fast you're aging internally, which directly predicts your risk for serious disease. Here's why that matters. Research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is, nearly 90% of the biological aging is in your hands. Yes, it's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means you have a lot of control over it. I was surprised by my results, and I realized that I have some work to do. And I bet if you took the test, there might be a few changes that you need to make, listener. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed me how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. It was eye-opening. My true age was a few years higher than my current age. It was a wake-up call that I needed to make some serious changes. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, no doctor visit or big needles, just a quick, painless finger prick. You send off that tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. It's fast and hassle-free. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code Obscura to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use code Obscura at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. Listener, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies, and you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code Obscura. Forget one-size-fit-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for action and turn every touch into a full body experience. Listener, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days, but Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Obscura. So head to Mood.com. Find your functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code Obscura when you check out to save 20% off on your first order.
The man fell asleep, leaving Cindy chained up the entire time. By the time 5 hours had passed, Cindy needed to relieve herself again and had to resort to using a towel nearby the pool table. Cindy briefly considered hitting the man with a pool stick laying on the pool table, but figured if she killed him, she'd be left for dead. And if she didn't kill him, she'd wake him. When her captor awoke, Cindy begged to go home and promised she wouldn't tell anyone what happened. Instead, the man told her that because he liked her so much, he would take her in his plane to his cabin to have sex with her once more, and then bring her back to Anchorage. The man told Cindy that if she tried to escape or get anyone's attention, he'd kill both her and them. But if she cooperated, he'd let her go. He told her he'd taken lots of girls up there, for fun, and that he already had an alibi, as his friends were willing to lie for him. But Cindy knew she wouldn't be returning. The man forced Cindy to lay down on the back seat of his car, covered up. In the passenger seat of the vehicle, she noticed a rope and a gun. The pair arrived at Merrill Airfield, just outside Anchorage. The man left Cindy in the car while he tended to a light plane parked on the airstrip. Cindy saw him put a firearm into the plane and fiddle with the seat in the cockpit. She saw her chance, and opening the car door, she sprang from the back seat, running as far into town as she could. The last thing she saw as she looked behind her was the man chasing her, wielding a gun, shouting, "Stop, you bitch! Stop, or I'll kill you!" A hysterical Cindy ran partially dressed, barefoot, and handcuffed all the way to 6th Avenue and flagged down a passing truck. She screamed at the motorist, "He's going to kill me," and begged him to take her to the Mush Inn, where Cindy asked staff to call her pimp to come and get her. The motorist continued on to work, where he then contacted police. Cindy, meanwhile, was taken to the Big Timber Motel, where she was staying. Disturbed by the state of Cindy's distress and unable to calm her down, her pimp took off with a gun towards Merrill Airfield on a vigilante mission of his own. Cindy still had the handcuffs on and was desperately trying to remove them when police arrived in the Big Timber Motel. Cindy was then taken to APD headquarters, where she gave a formal statement and relived her horrific experience. Despite her extreme distress, Cindy described in detail what she saw in the man's house and basement. She saw women's clothing in the laundry and toys in the den. Cindy told the APD that her abductor wanted her to say nasty things. She had memorized the location of the house and the tail number of the plane, a Piper Super Cub. She also told police that she had left her blue pumps on the passenger side floor of the Buick's back seat at the airport, as evidence that she'd been inside the car. Cindy described her attacker as wiry, scruffy, 5'6" tall with glasses and a stutter. The nature of her description about the car, plane, and the man's house were so detailed that the police were compelled to check it out. Cindy was taken to the hospital for a rape exam, where she was found to have vaginal bruising as well as shackle marks around her neck and wrists. Cindy told police that during her ordeal, she was on her period. Being a quick thinker, instead of removing and discarding her tampon during the assault, she kept it in the hopes that police could use it to obtain forensic evidence. Cindy told police, "This motherfucker wasn't going to get away with it. I knew I was in trouble. But if there was any chance of me getting away, he wasn't getting away with it." After Cindy gave her statement, investigators drove her to Merrill Airfield, where she identified the plane. While they were there, a security guard approached police to report that at 5:14 a.m. that day, he had seen a white male wearing a green coat and a cap, running from the plane to a green vehicle. Something about the situation had seemed off, and the security guard wrote down the vehicle's license plate, which he gave to the police. The license plate number matched a green Buick, registered to Robert Hansen. Listener, you'll recall from part one that 44-year-old Robert was a well-known Anchorage businessman and avid hunter who ran a popular local bakery. He moved from Iowa to Alaska in 1967 with his wife and soon fell right at home, often going out in his light plane to hunt wildlife on the outskirts of town. Robert Hansen wasn't home when police arrived to question him about Cindy's claims. But when he pulled up moments later, police noted that he fitted the physical description Cindy had provided. When police informed Robert of the allegations against him, he was shocked, but consented to a police search of his home, business, vehicles, and plane, as well as an interview. The search revealed that Cindy had indeed been inside Robert's house and car at some stage, but there was no evidence in the house or car that any rape or physical assault had taken place, as Cindy claimed. A loose-fitting wall panel in the house revealed a stash of weapons stored in the cavity behind it, but given Robert was a keen hunter and had kids in the house, it was no surprise they were stored in such a concealed way. A revolver was recovered by police, but inconsistent with the one as described by Cindy. Another reason an arrest would prove difficult was because Robert's alibis checked out. During his interview, Robert told police the night Cindy claimed she was kidnapped, he was at a friend's house from 5 to 11:30 p.m., repairing an airplane seat. He then visited another friend where he stayed until 5:30 a.m. that morning, finally driving to the airport to install the repaired seat. Robert told police that he'd never met Cindy, and that his family was away in Europe on summer vacation. In an attempt to show how absurd he found the whole situation, Robert joked to police, "You can't rape a prostitute, can you?" The day following her abduction, Cindy picked Robert out of a lineup without hesitation, but she refused to take a polygraph test, and when she suddenly left town soon after, the APD decided to take the word of the respected local businessman with a solid alibi against the word of a sex worker, whom they concluded had fabricated her story. Besides, this was the guy who ran the business where the cops bought their donuts and coffee. Sex workers had a reputation for being unreliable when it came to assisting in police investigations at the best of times. But this distrust went both ways. Sex workers and exotic dancers were all too familiar with the judgment and disdain from the local community. Even if police could identify the whereabouts of a woman who worked in a club or brothel, there was no guarantee they'd even be provided with the correct name. Many of the women went by stage names, so sometimes you never really knew who you were talking to. And for the APD, whose investigative resources were already stretched, Cindy's kidnapping and rape, serious as it was not murder. Reports made to police by sex workers who had been attacked or victimized by their clients or pimps simply weren't prioritized, and it appeared to Cindy Paulson, at least, that her claims would be treated the same way. The unsolved murders of the missing dancers took priority when it came to police resources. With no further evidence to corroborate Cindy's account, the investigation into her abduction was officially suspended. But something about it didn't sit right with APD officer Greg Baker, who continued to make inquiries. For Officer Baker, it was clear that it was only a matter of time before another young woman went missing in the Anchorage area, and only a matter of time before another body turned up. On September 2, 1983, just 3 months after Cindy Paulson's abduction and rape, road construction crew found decomposed human skeletal remains buried in a shallow grave on the banks of the Kinnick River. When troopers investigated, they found the body of a woman wearing tan boots. The victim was clothed, however, her jeans were unbuttoned and unzipped, and her striped sweater and bra had been cut in half at the front. The remoteness of the location was puzzling. It wasn't far from where Sherry Morrow's body had been found just over a year earlier, but the only way this place could be accessed was by boat or light plane. At the autopsy the day after the body was discovered, the victim was estimated to be aged in her late 20s to early 30s. She had been raped, and the cause of death was a single gunshot wound to the sternum from a .223 caliber bullet, which had passed through her heart with the shell casing found near her body. The victim had been naked when shot, and then dressed after she was killed. Given the advanced state of decomposition, police had to rely on dental records and managed to identify her as 30-year-old Paula Goulding. Paula grew up in Kona, Hawaii, but moved to Alaska and found work as a secretary in the Fairbanks area. She soon relocated to Anchorage to try her hand at exotic dancing at the Great Alaskan Bush Company. Paula's co-worker and roommate eventually reported her missing to the APD, saying she hadn't been seen since April 24th when she went to meet a man for a date, whom she had met at a bar. It was reported that the man had offered Paula $200 to meet him for lunch, but was adamant that she take a cab to their agreed meeting place. Police were disturbed at the similarities between Sherry Morrow and Paula Goulding's murders, and the discovery of Paula's body convinced State Trooper Sergeant Glenn Flothy that a serial killer was stalking the streets of Anchorage. Ballistics evidence from the shell casings at the Morrow and Goulding crime scenes had been sent to the FBI in Washington, D.C. for further analysis. The state troopers established a task force to investigate and link similarities between the reports of missing women and the known murder victims, but these reports were difficult to investigate. Given the transient nature of the floating population itself, Anchorage wasn't a place where exotic dancers and sex workers settled down to build a steady clientele. It was challenging for police to trace women who arrived in town, only to leave a few weeks or months later to seek work elsewhere. Law enforcement set to work educating women in the area about how to protect themselves, especially exotic dancers and sex workers. By September 1983, 15 potential suspects had been identified as possibly responsible for abducting, raping, and murdering a slew of young women in the area. So far, police had visited bars and clubs where women provided them with names of men they called bad dates. Guys who were creepy or just gave them a weird vibe and made them feel unsafe or fearful. Police conducted thorough background checks on these men, but so far, had come up with nothing. Meanwhile, APD officer Greg Baker continued to investigate the abduction and rape of 17-year-old Cindy Paulson. Like Sergeant Flothy, Officer Baker couldn't shake the feeling that Cindy's traumatic experience and detailed account was not only truthful, but directly linked to the reports of missing women in the Anchorage area. The investigation into Cindy's claims by the APD had been officially closed by senior officers, but Officer Baker couldn't ignore his instinct that told him that Robert Hansen was more involved than originally suspected. Unable to wait while more women went missing, Officer Baker defied his superiors and started digging around. Researching Robert's hard copy police and court records from every town he had lived prior to arriving in Anchorage, in order to determine whether his criminal history was more extensive than first thought. Robert's prior arson conviction proved that Officer Baker was on the right track. Officer Baker sent hard copies of Robert Hansen's criminal records, as well as a report detailing his suspicions to Sergeant Glenn Flothy, who was heading up the state trooper's investigation. Sergeant Flothy's review of missing persons data in Alaska revealed 8 similar cases that formed a pattern. The missing women were in their late teens to their 20s, between 5'4" and 5'7" tall, and weighed between 120 and 125 pounds. Cindy Paulson was consistent with his victim profile, and the information provided by Cindy several months earlier put Robert Hansen at the top of Sergeant Flothy's list of suspects. Sergeant Flothy also found that Robert owned a cabin near the site where bodies had been recovered. And of all the men on the suspect list, he was the only one who owned a plane. The state troopers began monitoring Robert Hansen's flights in and out of Merrill Airfield, but came up with nothing. Though there was still no direct evidence linking Robert to the murders of Sherry Morrow and Paula Goulding, the more Sergeant Flothy learned, the more he became convinced he had found his killer. Sergeant Flothy reached out to the FBI in Quantico, Virginia, for assistance in pinpointing behavioral characteristics that could lead him to their suspect. The FBI was specific in their response. "Don't tell us about your theories about the suspect. Tell us about the victims and the crime scenes, and we'll tell you who did it." The book Butcher Baker, The True Account of an Alaskan Serial Killer, explains how world-renowned behavioral analyst John Douglas and his colleague Roy Hazelwood compiled the following profile. The killer would be an experienced hunter with low self-esteem, have a history of being rejected by women, and would feel compelled to keep souvenirs of his murders, such as victims' jewelry or even body parts as trophies. They propose that the killer was a hard-working, successful businessman aged between 33 to 44, who was married to a woman who was likely highly religious or unaware of her husband's activities. They also suggested that the assailant might stutter. The perpetrator specifically chose sex workers and exotic dancers due to the transient nature of their work and the fact that they usually went unnoticed. The abuse of sex workers was a way for the perpetrator to seek revenge on women. The profile fit 44-year-old Robert Hansen to a T. And then another disappearance was reported. 20-year-old Daylin Frey arrived in Anchorage from Baltimore, Maryland. Her parents were divorced, and her ex-military father was an absent parent who required ongoing care following an aneurysm. Daylin, who worked as an exotic dancer under the name Sugar to support a reported heroin dependency, was reported missing in September 1983, but hadn't been seen since the previous April. Meanwhile, troopers expanded their search of the Kinnick River area. They were confident that the body count was far higher than the 3 that had been found so far, but the area was so fast and so remote that a full sweep of the area was impossible, and troopers came up empty-handed. In an investigation that had gathered a significant amount of purely circumstantial evidence, they were close, just not close enough. Investigators contacted 17-year-old Cindy Paulson, who had escaped from Robert Hansen the previous June, to see if she could remember anything else. They were in luck. Cindy identified a long barrel rifle known as a Thompson Contender as the one used during her kidnapping and owned by Robert. At a follow-up interview on September 27, 1983 with Sergeant Flothy, Cindy recounted part of her encounter with Robert.
And he had called me, and I slept through it when I was supposed to meet him. So the next day, which was Sunday, I was on the corner of 5th and Denali, and the gentleman here rode by in Golden parking lot and offered me, you know, I got in the car voluntarily and was talking with this man, and he offered me $200 for a blowjob in the car. And I said, fine, no problem. Pulled over to the side, by the side of the house, and I proceeded to give him a blowjob. And after I had got the condom on, I kept doing it, and then he kept falling around my neck like he was just tripping, playing around with my neck and my necklaces. And he had cuffed one of my hands, and I was trying to get loose, and he pulled out a gun. And he got my other hand cuffed. I don't know how he did, just from fighting him, because I didn't really, I fought, but not a lot, because I knew I needed to do something. And he took me to his house on Old Barber Road in Malibu. Took me downstairs, and then he had a dog, a black dog, and another dog, Pants. And I was handcuffed the whole time, and he brought a chair over, and he kept telling me, you know, if I cooperate, you won't hurt me. And he handcuffed me to the chair at first, and then he changed the hands and handcuffed me to the bottom of the other chair and had my neck tied with a rope around the coffee table and maybe on a brick screw rope. And I was on my period at the time, and I had a tampon in my womb, and he had sex with me with no rubber. And then he kept telling me, you know, calm, you know, that if I'd be okay, he won't hurt me. And then after that, I went to use the bathroom, and he was falling behind me for a little while in the neck. And I was handcuffed the whole time, and I was in the bathroom, and it started to come out. And he told me to go back in. And I just heard chains start rattling. And I came out. And he laid a little bed down on the floor by over by the pool table. And he wrapped the chain around my neck four times. And he handcuffed me and laid me down on the little bed. And I was there for about 5 hours. And then about 5 hours later, he woke up. And came over there and told him all I wanted to do was go home, that I'd live with my mom, and that I would never tell nobody. And the whole time, he never took none of my money, none of my jewelry. And he told me that since he liked me so good, that he would take me to his cabin, and make love to me one time and bring me back. And he said that he had a plane over at Merle Airfield, that we would go there, and then he would take me to his cabin and bring me back. And I knew that he was going to come back. And so we're getting ready to go, and he still didn't take none of my money. And nothing from me, but I just knew he was going to shoot. And we get in the car, and I'm laying down on the back seat with the cover over me. And we're driving down to the Merle Airfield. We get to the airport, and in the passenger seat, he had a rope and a gun. And he got out and put something in the trunk and put the gun on the top of the car. And he was digging in the trunk. He said he had to put his seat in so he could tie me up in the plane. And he kept going back from the trunk to the plane. And then when he went back to the plane, I looked up and I seen him. I could only see him from the waist down. and the front driver's door was open, the back door. And I ran, and he started chasing me with the gun.
On September 29th, 1983, Cindy's forensic evidence was collected by the APD from the hospital. And on October 11th, it was sent to the FBI. This included Cindy's clothing, samples of her head hair, pubic hair, vaginal fluid stains on her tampon. By mid-December 1983, the FBI determined that Robert Hansen was the likely source of the semen found on Cindy's underwear. And law enforcement was confident that they could link the murders of seven women to the Anchorage baker. State troopers arranged 24-hour surveillance to be conducted on Robert, and what they found was concerning. In the early hours of the morning, Robert was observed cruising the darkened streets of Anchorage in his vehicle. By this stage, Robert knew that the police were sniffing around, and investigators worked doggedly to pursue the proverbial smoking gun that would make their case airtight. Law enforcement again reached out to FBI behavioral analyst John Douglas, who flew to Alaska to assist with the investigation. He suggested that police bring Robert in for questioning while forensic officers simultaneously searched his home without knowledge. If all went according to plan, Robert would confess. It's not unusual for state authorities to seek the assistance of the FBI in cases involving violent offenses. But in a watershed legal precedent for investigative strategy, this was the first time in the history of U.S. law enforcement that a psychological profiling would be used as the basis of executing a search warrant. The warrant for Robert's home included women's jewelry and driver's licenses, firearms as described by Cindy Paulson, and the one that killed both Sherry Morrow and Paula Goulding.
Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again, after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please!
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.